Abortion. What is abortion? My definition, the one I've made up, is that it is deliberate termination of pregnancy to prevent the separate existence of a human baby. How is abortion done? And there you can see that representation up there is a uterus, and with a baby. It's not a jellyfish, that's a baby in there. And the common method that's used in early pregnancy these days is that a suction curette is put in. It's like a hollow part with a bit cut out there like a knife. It goes up after the cervix or neck of the womb is forcibly dilated, and that goes in and starts to cut strips off, and it more or less minces up the contents, and they're sucked out into a vacuum jar at the bottom there. That was a major advance in abortions when this suction curette came in the 60s, and probably is the commonest method of abortion these days. To be honest, most women who have abortions have no problems afterwards. However, there are complications, and you can well imagine that bleeding is a complication. Infection is another one. Perforation of the uterus can occur, albeit uncommonly. You can imagine that that thing slicing strips off and mincing up the tissue, and it gets into the wall of the uterus, it can start mincing up the wall of the uterus. And in fact, I myself was called on to deal with, just a matter of weeks ago, a lady who came from one of the private abortion clinics, nigh unto death, where they'd gone right through the side there, and she had about 11 pint blood loss before we got it to theatre and then removed her uterus as a life-saving measure. So that's a serious complication. Another one is damage to the cervix or neck of the womb, so that the cervix is left incompetent, and so that can cause a problem in the future with prematurity or recurring miscarriages. Some of the long-term problems besides psychological ones are the problem of infertility, prematurity, and if infection has got in, chronic pain. Chronic pelvic pain, pain with periods, and pain at intercourse. Other methods of abortions that are modern methods are a substance called prostaglandins, can be used to make the uterus contract and expel the contents. There's another newer method that is around, it's not widely used, where an injection is put through into the uterus with a substance to kill the baby so that the woman comes into labour in the days following. And there is another method used for advanced pregnancies where an instrument is put up through the cervix, the cord is fished for and brought down and cut so that the baby dies, and then another day or so later the substance to make the uterus contract is given. How common is abortion? The Royal Commission into Human Relationships that was chaired by Archbishop Arnott some years ago, you may recall, estimated that there were something like 60,000 abortions being performed in Australia each year. That is probably an underestimate. It perhaps is more like 100,000 abortions being done each year. Of these people having abortions, a half of them are single. They're by far the commonest group. A third of them are married. A sixth of them are divorced. And this is the significant thing, that one in three of the women in Australia having abortions is under the age of 20 years. And so it seems that there's an abortion for about every three or four births in Australia. There's one of the maternity hospitals in South Australia that made interesting reading to read their annual report that they put out, that in fact they'd done more abortions than they'd done deliveries that particular year. So that abortions are very common in Australia, and what is perhaps not realised is that with our current lifestyles and such like, it is estimated on pretty good epidemiological grounds, I may say, work done by the family planning clinics in Sydney, that 40% of Australian girls are likely to become pregnant before they reach the age of 20 years. Now that I was staggered to read that, but once I started to keep my eyes open, it seems to me that that figure is probably not inaccurate. Now of the 40% who conceive, that is of the 40 and 100, 7 or 8 will go ahead and give birth to an illegitimate child. 5 of them will marry because of pregnancy. 6 will have already married and the conception will be within the marriage. And by far the greatest number, that's 20, or half of those girls who get pregnant before the age of 20 will have had an abortion. So you can see that that's a very relevant sort of subject for life, like what it is out in the suburbs and the cities of this country. So that it seems to me that if one is a church leader in a church or assembly which is reaching out into the community and meeting people where they are at, the church leaders of such a church are likely to find that they're going to have to deal with some of these problems. By far the commonest problem will be pregnancy in the single girl. Less commonly, church elders may be asked for advice in the woman who has undergone antenatal diagnosis for fetal abnormality. With modern medical advances, there are now over 40 inherited diseases in the baby which can be detected by doing tests in the first 4 or 5 months of life. The commonest of those diseases is Down syndrome. So, of course, there are women who undergo this testing and it is found that they do have an abnormal child. Is it right for them to have an abortion? Less commonly again, perhaps, though certainly common from the medical point of view, or at least in my situation, is rape leading to pregnancy. What's the attitude of the Christian? What would be your attitude if one of the women in your assembly came to ask for advice because she'd been raped and pregnancy had followed on? We'll have a little bit to say about that later on. And then probably least common for you, yet it does occur, I can tell you, is pregnancy in an adulterous situation. And before we get down to the subject of abortion itself, back to the single girl who is pregnant, she is in quite a situation, as we can easily understand. And the options open to her are abortion. And it seems to me that as soon as a girl is devastated by the news that she is pregnant, often the first thing that comes to her mind is she must get an abortion. And if she goes to a boyfriend and tells him, that's often his first reaction too. Is it right? Is that, if some of our girls come along, and I'm very conscious, I've got 2 girls in their late teenage years, and there but for the grace of God go I, and who knows that I'll not be facing this one day. It's probably the father of every daughter has got to face up to this in the back of his mind. Please God, we won't have to face up to it, but who knows. John White, the quite outstanding writer and speaker, points out that if an abortion is done just because of it's a way out of dodging an embarrassing situation, and there are some who are associated with Christian denominations who do have abortions, that here's where consonant dissonance comes in. Because I have had women who come to me and have asked for an abortion, and I've said, well, what do you mean? What's your attitude to abortion? They said, oh, I don't believe in abortion. Or I didn't believe in it, but now I'm so desperate when this has happened that my beliefs have gone out the window and I'm prepared to practice something quite differently from what I subscribe to in my head. And we all know that we can function on different levels. We can function on the intellectual level sometimes, and other times we function purely at the emotional level. For example, if we're a driver in a car that's been involved in a major accident, in those first 5 minutes afterwards, we're unlikely to think coherently, and our attitude and behaviour is more likely at that time to be governed by our emotions rather than the set of principles that we subscribe to. And I guess there is the Christian man, a godly man perhaps, who's got out and abused the other driver in the first 5 minutes of a road accident. That would be a case of consonant dissonance. And a lady sometimes, being devastated with the knowledge that she's pregnant, may turn to abortion as the first line out. The shotgun wedding, and again, sometimes in church circles, this has been the way out. But it's a rather risky way out, because it's been shown by a study done in the USA that 60% of all marriages under the age of 20 in the USA have broken up irreparably within 12 months of marriage. And that the figure was even higher when the reason for the marriage was a pregnancy. Adoption. Keep the baby, but put the baby up for adoption. This is a risky thing. It's risky for the baby because we do have follow-up figures now for babies that are put out for adoption, and a rather sad tale that is. We also have follow-up studies now on women who have put babies out for adoption, and we do know that when they're happily married 20, 30 years later and got four children of their own, there still is part of them that's hankering back after that adopted child, and even decades afterwards that can come back to haunt them. However, sometimes it may well be the best thing, despite the problem of the outcome for the child and despite the problem of hang-ups for the mother. And then there is the fourth option. I can think of only four things that a woman can do or a single girl can do in this situation, and that is to keep the baby. But for this to be successful, she needs a loving family, and if she's associated with a church or an assembly or a fellowship, she needs a supportive church fellowship. And it seems to me that most church fellowships don't have what it takes to give that degree of support. That this is an area that if we're to be relevant to the people round about, we need to upgrade the level of support within our fellowships. Just before we go on and get right down to the business of abortion, I want to say something about contraception, and abortion. Is there a clear-cut difference between the two? I'm making a number of these preliminary remarks because there are some people who, without thinking about things in sufficient depth, rather glibly, come down to a rock-solid answer and that they're not amenable to any argument from the other side. Now, can I suggest that some of these problems that touch people where they are at in this century are complex, and we do well not to have glib, pat answers, but to have thought things through from the scriptural point of view and from other points of view so that our answers really are relevant to the people where they're at. Now, traditionally, contraception has been regarded as preventive action taken before fertilisation, clearly different from abortion, which occurs after fertilisation. But with medical advances, there's a problem arising. For example, one method of contraception these days is the intrauterine contraceptive device, a little bit of plastic that's put up into the uterus and is almost as effective as the pill. The trouble is, no one knows for sure how it works, but probably it does work as an early abortifacient. That is, it produces abortions before the woman even realises that she's pregnant. So that this intrauterine contraceptive device seems to straddle that line between contraception on the one hand and abortion on the other. In fact, the line now seems wide and blurred, so much so that a working party of the British Council of Churches came up with a definition to say that conception is not complete until the egg is implanted. But are they right? On the other hand, who's to say that they're wrong? And that brings us to a theological point that I want to address now so that we can have it in the back of our minds as we look at the practicalities. When does ensoulment occur? Because to me, this is highly relevant to the whole thing. By the soul, and this is my own definition culled from a number of different places, by the soul I mean that distinctly human part of life which is the seat of physical appetite, the source of the emotions, associated with the will and the moral action, and expresses the whole personality of man, it is that part which survives death. So that, in other words, we could be asking, when does personal life begin in this little embryo or fetus? Or, at what stage must the status of a person with rights be recognised? And so that brings us to a number of different viewpoints on this. And the Roman Catholic viewpoint, and probably a lot of traditional Protestant viewpoint, has been that ensoulment occurs at fertilisation. However, with modern advances, the person who holds to this view, that the soul comes in and is that unique little individual right at fertilisation, has got a few practical problems to face up to. The first is, with in vitro fertilisation that is being done in some centres these days, where the ovum or the egg is put into a petri dish and the sperm fertilises the egg in that dish. Does that mean that ensoulment is occurring in the petri dish or the test tube? Look at twinning. We know that with identical twins, there is a fertilised ovum, and sometime after fertilisation, sometimes a considerable time afterwards, that fertilised egg splits into two. And so you have identical twins. Now, if ensoulment has occurred at fertilisation, does it mean that those identical twins have got the same soul? Or to take it a bit further, in veterinary science, what they have done is they've got the fertilised ovum out of a cow, and with a laser beam, they've cut that fertilised ovum down the middle and put one half into one cow, put one half into another cow, so that later on these two cows have given rise to beasts, given birth to beasts which have come from the same egg. Now, from the technical point of view, there's no reason why the same could not be done with humans, with embryo splitting and embryo transfer and surrogate mothers. Now, if that were done with humans, does that mean that it's possible with a laser beam to split the soul into two? But there's another problem facing that if we just say that ensoulment occurs right at the beginning of life, that is, at fertilisation. We do know that a lot of women have miscarriages. We used to say something like 20, 25, 30%. It's now known, with better methods of testing, that up to 70% of all pregnancies perish as miscarriages. Often the woman has barely missed a period and she doesn't even recognise that she's been pregnant. Now, if ensoulment has occurred at fertilisation, does that mean that the majority of humans in heaven will be unrecognisable as such, never having completed organogenesis, that is, never having formed human organisms or human organs or taken on human form? Now, if we take that a little bit further, thinking theologically, accepting the doctrine of original sin, does that mean that Christ's atoning death on the cross of Calvary was largely and predominantly for a whole lot of miscarriages? The mind boggles at that, and yet I have to say that I have discussed this with an evangelical professor of theology, and he sees no difficulty with that concept. I do. If I was asked, which I have been, when do I think ensoulment occurs, I tend to say that I think it is a process that goes on. It begins at fertilisation, and that it is complete at birth. Because at the other end of the spectrum of life, that is death, we now know that the body and the person do not necessarily cease to exist at the same time. We've got this legal concept these days of brain death. If some young fellow drives his car into the telegraph pole and has a head injury and taken into the hospital, and his brain is irreparably damaged and all functions have gone, he can be pronounced dead. But with these life support systems, they can keep his heart and lungs going until they switch them off. But before they switch them off these days, they can sort of take his heart for a heart transplant and the kidneys and the liver and such like, as we well know from reading the newspapers. You see, because death is now regarded as a process, so that there's no reason to demand that the body and the person should necessarily start at the same time, because the body and the person do not necessarily cease to exist at the same time. Some people say that ensoulment occurs at birth, that it is that first breath that the baby takes when God gives it its life. And that makes a bit of sense. There seems to be some biblical backing for this. For example, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, we read, God took a man, or really it could be literally translated, God took a fully formed man and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And that makes a lot of sense to the obstetrician. Now these days, it's expected of fathers to be present when their wives are having babies in labour ward. It's almost as if the poor father's got to have a note if he's not going to be there. Now I guess some of you have noticed in the labour room that when that baby is delivered and takes that first breath or that first cry, there's an almost audible sigh of relief goes around the room. And to the obstetrician, it seems that there's something very significant about that first breath. As in contrast to the stillbirth, when during labour one might have felt that baby ticking inside the mother's tummy, might have been hearing the fetal heart, but something goes wrong and that baby is born dead, and it doesn't seem the same. It's sad, but it's not as bad as where a baby is born alive and then dies, because the feeling seems to be, here is a fetus which almost made it. But if we accept that ensoulment occurs at birth, we've got some theological problems, because we read in the scriptures that God was interested in this man or that before his birth. For example, in Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 5, before I formed you in the belly, I knew you, God said to Jeremiah. Before you came out of the womb, I sanctified you. But the person who accepts that point of view has also got obstetric difficulties. Because we know now that with ultrasound techniques, breathing movements are taking place by the baby in utero long before birth. Traditionally, a large section of the Christian church, and particularly the early church fathers, believed that ensoulment occurred at the time when movements were first felt, or quickening, as it's called, somewhere around about 4 months. And the creed speaks about, the apostolic creed speaks about the quick and the dead. And again, there seems to be some biblical support for this. For example, Luke 1:41 refers to quickening and also that divine breath, the Holy Spirit coming into someone, all in together in the one verse, where it says, and it came to pass that when Elizabeth heard the salutation of Mary, the baby leaped in her womb, the movements, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Ghost. The difficulty for this point of view is that ultrasound tells us that the baby's moving long before the mother first feels quickening. Now, more recently, I myself have been pondering on the possibility that ensoulment occurs at sentience. What is sentience? I define sentience as that capacity for sensation or feeling. That is, when the individual can feel or can respond to stimuli or show other evidence of being consciously aware of the environment. Now, if ensoulment doesn't occur till that stage, which is certainly no less than 8 weeks, we'd believe, and possibly a bit more, it could well be that there's no theological problem with those 70% of pregnancies which abort or miscarry long before they reach 8 weeks. It could also mean, perhaps, that abortion early on in a pregnancy is not the heinous sin that we traditionally tend to think it is, but perhaps more of that later on. However, can I say from all this that it is important to realise, as R.F.R. Gardner says, who is a ordained minister of the Free Church of Scotland, and also a consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist, and he also worked as a missionary doctor in earlier years in the same hospital that I worked at in Africa. He says this, any attempt to build Christian ethical principles on reproductive physiology is vain and ought to be abandoned because knowledge is advancing all the time. So that we've got to be careful that we don't read into the scriptures what our present understanding of physiology is, because sure as anything, 10 years' time, the people who've got more knowledge than we are doing the same thing will read something different into the scriptures. When does ensoulment occur, we ask? My answer is, I don't know. I wish I did. But I'm mentioning this to show the complexities and to point out that we do well to avoid being glib and shallow in our approach to this problem and also to related questions, I may say. Now, medical advances have occurred since the 60s in abortion techniques. So that abortion is pretty common. It's now known that there have been over 2 million abortions performed in the United Kingdom since the Pregnancy Termination Act came in 1967. And it's important for Christians to develop an attitude to abortion because the principles that they apply and the attitudes that they use to abortion are going to spill over, surely, into other issues such as euthanasia and infanticide. And it seems to me that what we say about abortion, a few years down the track, we'll be saying about these other things. Now, what about the antenatal diagnosis of fetal abnormality? Just yesterday, I was told about and asked about a lady who has been diagnosed as having a viral infection early on in her pregnancy, which almost certainly has affected the baby. The tests seem to show that it has, and when that baby is born, it will be mentally retarded with a small head because of that viral infection that she has, and because of the viral infection the mother has had, which has crossed over to the baby. It will also have a lot of other multiple abnormalities with it. Now, the major problem for the Christian is whether abortion of a fetus shown to have a serious or lethal defect is justified. And there are some Christian doctors, in fact one who is far more godly than I am, who believes that it is justified and that he will perform an abortion in, say, a woman who's been proven to have German measles early on in the pregnancy, because we know that serious abnormalities such as blindness, deafness, heart defects and mental retardation will occur in something like 60% of those babies. And it's said by this point of view that that child will face much suffering. The mother will suffer, the family will suffer, and the community will have to bear a great cost, because with these handicapped children, they cost, just in healthcare, something like $100,000 each. I myself was faced with a 44-year-old lady who had two girls, one aged 15, one aged 13. The first one had a condition called progressive muscular dystrophy, which, as the years went on, she had weakness, and by the age of 15, that child couldn't get out of bed without being helped, couldn't walk. They lived in the country, and for the mother to go shopping each week, the neighbours had to come from the neighbouring farm to come and look after that child, who was expected to die in the years to come. Fortunately, it looked as if the 13-year-old child was all right, except that that child was suffering psychological problems because of all the care that mum and dad had to put in and day out to the first child. She'd been taking the pill for 12 years because she couldn't bear the thought of facing this again. But something went wrong and she conceived, and it was declared that she had a 1 in 4 chance of having another baby like this. And she said, look, it's just wrecked our family. We're just flat out, the whole family's geared around looking after this 15-year-old girl. We just won't be able to cope if another one comes along. What would the Lord Jesus Christ do in a situation like that? What's his will? If you're a church elder and someone comes to you, what would you do? Brings us to rape. I myself have dealt with a 13-year-old girl who was presented with the request for abortion because she'd been raped. I myself have a lot of difficulty in this one, and as a Christian, I find it awfully difficult. But there's another Christian doctor who writes this. He says, pregnancy due to rape. A girl is carrying an egg that she intends to discard. Before she can do so, in the course of nature, some wretch seizes her and fertilizes the egg. Should it be allowed to develop thus? Is this what God wants? Does he want the girl to go through all the shame and misery and disruption of hopes and plans that this would entail? There are those who would stand before the girl and insist that they have impeccable logic according to which they deduce from Scripture that she must go through with it, that God requires this of every woman whose eggs are fertilised through whatever course, except perhaps in special cases where her life would be at risk. And he goes on, "This fills me as a Christian with deep shame. The logic I have seen deployed strikes me as being not even plausible, let alone impeccable. I feel disgraced that so many evangelicals have aligned themselves with others who take this line." Rather strong words, and I feel a bit condemned because in fact that's the line I take that he's that he's speaking against. "And who repeat time and again the unwarranted claim to have divine authority in doing so. We cannot expect God's blessing on an enterprise whose argumentation depends on support from scriptures which do not, even if wrenched from their context and read literally, logically lead to the consequences attributed to them." So I find this problem of rape a very real one. I had a 27-year-old woman who came along, and she'd been raped by a black man. And she was really going through it. She was having to be hospitalised because of the psychological upset of this. And her fear, amongst other things, was that if the pregnancy were to go on, everyone would know that it wasn't her husband because the baby could well be black. What's the mind of Christ in this sort of thing? There are extreme cases. I myself have dealt with a Vietnamese lady who was a refugee here, and she'd come with the second child, but they'd been boarded by pirates in the sea off Malaysia, and then their ship had been wrecked by a storm, and in the course of which the child drowned. She herself made it to shore and eventually to Australia. It was decided that the husband should not attempt to come, but should stay with the first child, who was 5 years old, until she'd worked here for 3 years, because then she could sponsor him coming. That would be safer than going through this sort of thing again. The trouble was that she then got a letter to say that the husband had decided not to come, that he had married another woman back in Vietnam, and so she would never see her first child again. She was very upset about this, feeling very lonely in a strange land. And working where she did, there was a workmate who was also of the same culture, and they began to get friendly together, and then a pregnancy came along, and she was devastated by this. Because by their culture, the shame was such that she would have to commit suicide. I put it to her that if she did not go ahead with an abortion, I would see that she was looked after for the rest of the 9 months, and that I would put her in touch with other Vietnamese Christians during that time. But she said no, she would still have to go through it, because if she didn't commit suicide and her parents got to hear of it, the shame would be such on them that her father would be expected to commit suicide. What's the mind of Christ in this sort of thing? I hope you're beginning to see that we do well not to have glib, pat, superficial answers when we come to look at the scriptures. Because if there was one thing the Lord Jesus Christ was not, when he dealt with similar sort of situations, he was not glib and pat and superficial. And that brings us now to what do the scriptures say? And the first thing that I want to point out is the authority of the scriptures in all matters of faith and conduct. 2 Timothy 3:7. All scriptures given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for correction, for reproof, for instruction in righteousness, and so on. But can I point out that there is a silence of the scriptures on this? As I've read through the scriptures, I can't see anywhere it says, "Thou shalt not do an abortion." Therefore, we have to look at the principles in scripture, and therefore, we have to bear in mind that different ones of us, looking at the same situation, weighing up scriptural principles, will weight some principles more heavily than others and will come to different conclusions. And that's just what has happened in this abortion sphere, where another Christian doctor and I have come to different conclusions on some of these matters. And yet we're both appealing to the scriptures or scriptural principles. Some people argue from negative evidence that because the scriptures do not mention abortion specifically, that therefore God does not invariably prohibit abortion. I myself don't agree with that. I think that that's taking it too far. But we need to look at some of these scriptural principles. And the first principle that it seems to me we need to take note of is the doctrine of sanctity of human life. God is the giver of life. For example, Zechariah 12:1. We could put up a lot of proof texts, but I've just picked out one for each of these. Thus says the Lord, who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth and formed the spirit of man within him. God is the one to whom every living soul belongs. Ezekiel 18:14. Behold, God speaking, all souls are mine. The soul of the Father, as well as the soul of the Son, is mine. Although there is a causal connection between sexual intercourse and conception, conception, as we look at the scriptures, and in fact, is not inevitable. The parents do not possess the power to ensure conception. In some instances, at least, conception is the gift of God. For example, Genesis 4:1. Eve said, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Sarah, Genesis 16:2, the Lord prevented me from having children. Genesis 17:9, God speaking to Abraham, your wife shall bear a son. And then in Genesis 29:31, the Lord opened Leah's womb. 30:22, the Lord opened Rachel's womb. Ruth 4:13, the Lord gave her, Ruth, conception. So that I put up as the first principle to apply in these situations, these real-life situations, is the doctrine of the sanctity of human life. The next principle is the divine interest in the fetus. And to me, this is fairly clearly taught in the scriptures. For example, Psalm 139, verse 13, Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret in the womb, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. And so it goes on. We read the same in Job chapter 10, verse 8. Thy hands fashioned and made me. Verse 9. Remember thou hast made me of clay. Verse 11. Thou didst clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews. Thou hast granted me life and steadfast love, and thy care has preserved my spirit. Speaking about the development of the fetus. And so to me, this is a powerful point that by God's power and under his supervision or oversight, fetal development occurs. But some Christians have been saying, and the chap that I quoted from that other article, a Christian in UK, points out, does that apply to the miscarriages? Or does it apply only to David, or to the elect, or to those who've made it into this world as recognisable human beings? Or is it not stretching things too much to apply it to every conception? And then we've mentioned Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 5. To me, that is probably the really important principle to apply, and yet, in my own reading this year, that's starting to come under a little bit of scrutiny as people like that are starting to write. And they're biblical scholars and committed evangelicals who are writing like that. The next principle I've put down there is that the fetus is not necessarily equated with a living person. And can I point out that we've got to be careful not to be glib when we approach abortion. There are some who glibly say abortion is murder. And it says in Genesis chapter 20, thou shalt do no murder. And so the right to lifers, for example, say that abortion is out of court completely. But we have this verse or this passage here in Genesis chapter 21, Exodus chapter 21 verse 22. When men strive together and hurt a woman with child so that there is a miscarriage, you got the picture there? Two men fighting and there's a woman standing by and she gets belted in the tummy by one of them as an accident. So that there is a miscarriage and yet no harm follows, the one who hurt her and caused the miscarriage shall be fined, according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, strike for strike. Can you see what it may be saying here? That is, that there is a difference seemingly implied between the fetus and the person because the punishment is different. But before we go too far down that line, we ought to say that there are different schools of interpretation because there's doubt about what the original Hebrew is saying there. Because I'm reading, I read that from the Revised Standard Version. If you've got the New International Version, what it's really saying there, according to the New International Version, is that if that woman is struck and she gives birth to a premature infant, but no harm follows, the baby's not deformed and survives, the man will pay a fine. But if that baby dies or is deformed or the mother's injured, well then, it's the old law, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and so on. And so there are these two views. In fact, there's a third view, which is held amongst biblical scholars. I myself incline to that first view, that there is a difference, but in honesty, I have to say that the more I read, the more it seems that the weight of biblical scholarship is against that interpretation of the Revised Standard Version and seems to be more in line with the New International Version. And so, it would seem that if that is true, the Bible does not equate. Rather, the Bible does not imply there is a difference between a living person and a fetus. I put that to you to let you see that I don't have hard and fast answers on this, because often, as it happens in the Word of God, the more deeply we read into it, sometimes the more involved things appear to be. The next principle that I think is important is that there are biblical grounds for taking life. Right to life is, say, glibly, thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not do murder. But then it goes on in that same chapter in Exodus chapter 21, where it sets out grounds where it is commanded that the life is to be taken. Verse 12, whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. Verse 15, whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Verse 16, whoever steals a man shall be put to death. And so it goes on in verse 17. And in fact, there are passages where God commands genocide, the extermination of a whole tribe or race of people, such as in 1 Samuel 15. So that there are biblical grounds for taking life. For example, again, we see that coming over into the New Testament in Acts chapter 5, verses 1 to 11, the story of Ananias and Sapphira. And so it would appear that in the New Testament, it was clear that life, physical life, was to be forfeited in certain special situations. Another principle is the principle of obedience, that God calls his people to obedience. And if I'm considering an abortion request, I'm conscious that all life belongs to God, that all God's people must obey him, even taking life when he wills it, but only when he wills it. And then the next thing, the next principle that has to obtain is the principle of love. The central commandment of the New Testament is to love the Lord our God utterly, and because of this, to love our neighbour, Matthew 22. I found that when I first was faced with this problem, it was an overwhelming problem, I found. It really worried me. But I tended to adopt a harsh legalism. I found the cure for that was when I was dealing with these patients, was to imagine that on the spare seat, the Lord Jesus Christ was sitting there. And it made a difference to my attitude and the way I conducted that interview. And that the other principle in this is that in approaching such a problem, a spirit of compassion rather than harsh legalism is enjoined. For example, in Luke 6, 36 to 37, we see how the Lord Jesus conducted himself. Now, what's the conclusion of that? And all I can do is give you my conclusion, is that as far as the scriptures are concerned, I believe that they establish the sanctity of life, but also stress the quality of life. That abortion is seen as an evil in any circumstance. Under some conditions, however, it may be a lesser evil than allowing the pregnancy to continue. Now, I was saying before that if we're in churches that are moving out and meeting people where they're at, we're going to find that people are so paying the price of sin that they're in such a situation that they can no longer do the right thing. For example, something not on abortion. I was asked to counsel someone who came to the Lord. She'd been living de facto with someone for about 18 years and she had a 15-year-old son to him. But she came to the Lord and was convicted that she ought to return to her first husband because he was the one that she was legally married to. Whereupon the 15-year-old boy went through a severe anxiety at the thought that his mother was going to leave that family. Now, whatever she does in that situation is not going to be right. You see, and we've got to be careful glibly not to say this is right and that's wrong, this is black and that's white, because we live in such a fallen, sinful, ambiguous world that the choice is often not between right and wrong, but between evil, between evils, choosing the lesser of two evils. And those of you involved in pastoral care, particularly with people who get converted, when they're living in de facto relationships or divorces and such like, will know something about what I'm talking about. I'm glad I'm not a full-time pastor because I think they've got some really tough ones to come to grips with these days on that. The life of the mother, her health, or the well-being of her whole family may be at stake. While the life of the fetus is sacred and valuable, its destruction may become necessary to preserve weightier human values, in the same way as capital punishment. We believe in the sanctity of life, but the execution of criminals for capital crimes is in obedience to a higher principle than the sanctity of that individual human life. Or killing in a just war, where it's possible that a British soldier can kill a Christian German, or a Christian Englishman can kill a Christian Argentinian over in the Falkland Islands. Is that right? And again, it could be that there's a higher principle overriding the value of the individual life. I have done abortions. In the last 8 years, I myself have accepted 4 people for abortions. 2 of them, I still have worries about, did I do the right thing? But when one does perform an abortion under these sort of circumstances, one feels very much like an executioner. And I've gone home at times and just knelt down and asked the Lord for forgiveness, having dealt with one of those things, because I don't know what's right or what's wrong in one of those situations. We just ask the Lord for guidance, do what we think is right, and then ask for his cleansing if we've ended up doing the wrong thing. There are others, many others, that I have refused, and it's very handy in Queensland because we still have the old 1864 criminal code here. It's very easy for us to reject them. But again, I've gone home and asked for forgiveness in case I've done the wrong thing and then committed people to a whole lot more suffering. Those who believe the Bible, I suggest, should look with severity on the practice of abortion, condoning it only in instances where abortion constitutes the lesser evil. We recognise particular cases can present great difficulties, but advocate a compassionate weighing up of all relevant factors and a decision made in obedience to the will of God as revealed in those scriptural principles as we try to weight them in each of those situations. And now I say that if they've been some of the most testing times dealing with some of these people, they've also been the most fruitful times, because often we're dealing with people when they've really hit bottom. And this sort of person, more than any other group, has often proved a fertile ground for speaking that word in season about the Lord Jesus Christ. Oh, how we need his wisdom, don't we? You who are assembly elders, as you deal with some of these problems, and we who are in the workplace dealing with them, we need the wisdom of God, don't we? If any of you lack wisdom, we're told in James, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith. And we need to rely on the Lord for wisdom. As we deal with these situations, you deal with them, and I deal with them, we need to have that attitude of love. Galatians 5:13, by love, serve one another. I love the passage in Micah chapter 6, and with this I close. Micah chapter 6, verses 6 to 8, where in these dilemmas, it's often impossible to do the right thing, because sins have been so tainted and skewed and distorted by sin that it's no longer a choice between right and wrong. What does the Lord require of you, it says there, but to do justice? Now these principles are important, and obedience to God's ways is expected of us. And as when those principles are applied in a certain situation, we come to a conclusion, we need to be uncompromising in those principles. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice? But then it goes on to love kindness, or that Hebrew word chesed, or mercy. There's got to be a balance, not just a harsh legalism. And as these people come to you in your church situation, you'll find that perhaps they are the most responsive to that word in season at that time. But we will be in dilemmas. We will perhaps make the wrong decision, and there is that need for forgiveness. And this is why I like the last part of this. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? And as we face these problems, it's a matter of our being humble before the Lord and open to him. Extent, yes. Legally, no, in Queensland, because under Queensland law, which in fact has not been judicially tested, under three sections of the Criminal Code of 1864, she does not have a right. Abortion is a criminal offence unless it's done to preserve the mother's life. Now, a legal interpretation has never been given in the Queensland courts of what that means, what the word life means, has never been tested what the word preserve means, but the mother has no rights. From that point of view, legally, she doesn't have rights. I find this one a difficult one, because the woman says, what right have you got to apply your principles, way out as they are, to my situation? I've actually had that said to me. And the answer to that is, well, look, I'm sorry, I believe that you do have rights, but also I have the right and also the responsibility not to be untrue to myself. Now, fortunately, most of them get the message and they disappear. There was one woman who was going through and it became fairly clear to her that she wasn't going to get accepted, and she exercised her right, because a day or two later I was rung up by a private anaesthetist asking for some details because she was going on a private operating list. But that's a thorny question.
What answer do you give to the person who says there isn't much difference in burden, principle between preventing life and ending unborn life? I mean prevention by any means.
There's no difference between prevention and termination of life. I would say that that's just not true. There are some Roman Catholics, extreme Roman Catholics, who say that the origin of life is divine and is not to be interfered with in any way. either to prevent it happening by using any contraception or to induce it happening by using these new fertility methods. And to give the Roman Catholics their due, at least they're consistent. And it's also very easy for them, because if the doctor says, I am never ever going to do a termination, it's easy for him. The answer is just no right away, and out the patient goes, and he doesn't have to wear his brains out thinking about it. But if you say, and the abortion clinic people who take everyone just about, also it's easy for them because they don't have to think about them. But it's the man in the middle who says, we will look at each particular situation that is having difficulty with everyone. I myself think that it is obviously different. If we could take that to the nth degree, is there any difference between the pill and termination of life by shooting a 40-year-old man? And clearly there is a difference. And logically, so that even though life is a continuum, it does so happen that there are points that are different from each other. In the same way that when we mix gases together, mix the molecules in, there's a continuous mixing and then there's a flame. And we can't really say at what point that flame comes. It's a continuous one, and yet it's very clear when there's a flame and when there's not a flame. So I would say there is a difference.
In respect to the comment that such a high percentage of fetuses aborted naturally, is God going to populate heaven with unformed children? My answer to that is, God is sovereign.
And in fact, the professor of theology comes down on that line and says that if the elect, he's coming down on the Calvinistic line of the elect, there's no reason why they should have to be born to inherit the kingdom of God in heaven, because if they are in the elect, the sovereign God can overrule even the matter of the abortion. Yes, yes. That starts to pass out beyond my sphere, and my mind can't grope with that, in the same way that I can't cope with, if life is found on another planet, will the sacrificial life or death of Christ be efficacious for people or organisms on another planet? My feeling is that it's not. That we were men were created, humans were created a little lower than the angels and crowned with glory and honour, and therefore exclusively and uniquely have the option of experiencing redemptive grace. And that sets us apart from animals, it sets us apart from people on another planet, and I would think that it sets us apart from the non-elect and from those who haven't been born. But I can't quote chapter and verse. It's a matter of which way we think.
Back on the dissonance question, that word again. I suppose I'm thinking of the term cognitive dissonance. You said consonant dissonance, whatever. You meant cognitive. All right.
Cognitive dissonance. Perhaps that's why I couldn't find it in the book.
Well, on the subject of cognitive dissonance, what is the impact on this whole thing? I mean, you're dealing with people. What do they think? And what is the impact on after they've had an abortion? How important is that in their life afterwards, the enduring psychological effects of, if that is the dissonance normally there? Or and if it is there, you know, how do they get on later in coping with it?
Right. What are the sequelae to this? I think in all honesty we have to say that the average Miss Australia in that 20 and 100 have an abortion before the age of 20 has no effects whatever after it. She may have regrets later on if she's faced with infertility when she does marry and settle down, but we're living almost in a post-Christian society where previous tenets are no longer held. For example, in the clinic just the other day we had a young girl who, the student was taking history, and she had not had intercourse. And he'd asked her, why had she not had intercourse? And he was so struck by the answer that he wrote down the history. Because I have chosen not to and am waiting till marriage. And he thought that was... And the two students, when I sort of almost chided him for asking her that he should be self-evident, they said that I was being judgmental. And it's pretty clear that amongst the young people that outside, that those tenets of God that we would think are self-evident are not being held by them. So therefore, there's certainly no qualms of conscience in many of them. In others, there is, and in all of them, they do go through a psychological grief reaction, however small. And this is where the humanists in particular are saying that we must be aware of this and treat them for their grief in those weeks after.
Dr. Bernard Nathan, in 1982, or something like that, wrote the book Aborting America. He was one of the first, if not the first, to open the clinic. And he came to a decision in his life where he said that abortion was morally indefensible. Suppose we went along and we felt that there are times when this should happen, abortion should take place, the termination of pregnancy. Can we, in all conscience, say, however, that babies who will be healthy should be terminated? Can we ever come? I, at the moment, I'm like you, I can't understand just exactly the whole circumstance, but a baby is going to be born a healthy person, become a healthy person. Where do you feel we stand in that?
You may have said
I can't quite get the point of...
The child is going to be healthy.
Yes.
We come to the place of aborting the child. Or are we only saying that the child should be aborted because it has will have a deformity or a deficiency or that through rubella or something like that, the child is going to be deformed?
It's a question of degree in practice. There are some conditions where you can be 100% sure, if one ever can be 100% sure about anything, but so close to it, that that baby is affected and will suffer serious defects. There are others where we don't know. All you know is that the chances are, and that lady I quoted, there was a 1 in 4. Now, it's very true. Where you can't be sure, if you do abortions, do you abort all four of them for the sake of preventing that handicapped one come and therefore sacrifice the life of the three others? Now, remember I said before that our attitude to abortion spills over into infanticide. There are others are saying it's better to allow the four children to be born and then to hit on the head the one that is found to have the defect. But our society won't come to that because while there's an easy approach to abortion, there's not an easy approach to infanticide. But people might be applying that argument in 20 years' time, 30 years' time, and doing just that. Also, when we do know that the baby is affected, to what degree is significant? If we're 100% sure that it's significant, do we abort the Mongols? And there are some that have very happy existences as Mongols, and they've enriched families. Other families have been devastated by them. Even when there are severe handicaps, say if there's a child incontinent of urine and feces and crippled and can't speak or talk and more particularly can't show affection and response, that's a dreadful burden on people. But again, families have been enriched by coming to grips with that. So it's very hard to draw the line somewhere because as sure as we draw that line, another case will come up which will cause us to question, is that where the line should be drawn? And if you're drawing the line where we're sure, as opposed to where there's a chance, that's still only a qualitative approach to it, and you can be shifted, or we can be shifted from that.
In the case of a 13-year-old lass being raped, what authority would the parents have in that case?
Well, in this case, the mother was demanding that she be terminated. As it turned out, I refused. Life became easy for us because I arranged psychiatrists and myself to see the mother and the girl together and separately. And after 7 hours, a total of 7 hours of interviewing, the story of the rape became unstuck and the girl confessed that she was frightened of mum. Now, it solved itself as far as I was concerned, gave me the letter. But the mother was demanding it, demanding her rights. She has no rights under our present law. That law that would have gone through with the Pregnancy Termination Act in 1981, but got thrown out, would have given rights for rape where there was a case capable of investigation by the police. It would have given a legal right to the parents to ask for an abortion for these minors within 3 months. I may say that we came under severe criticism by one of the liberal organisations, but they said, what right have you to subject a mother and a 13-year-old girl to 7 hours of questioning? You should have just done the termination.
In your statement there, you didn't make a great deal of a rule which seems to apply in some parts of the world whereby a pregnancy can be terminated easily in the first X months but not so easily in the next 9 minus X months. Do I then read that that is not the major criterion that you use at all?
You do, because I don't know when ensoulment occurs. So it's safer at this stage to regard it as being at fertilisation, but I can't justify that from the scriptures. If, however, it comes at sentience, say 12 weeks, it's easy. Anyone who comes along, provided there are sound medical reasons, can have an abortion up to 12 weeks, and there's no theological or ethical principle involved. That'll be nice and easy then. And again, there are some parts of the world which have legislated to set times like that. I deliberately haven't done that because of this business of we don't know. We just don't know. And anyone who claims he does know, I think is wrong.
Wasn't abortion practiced fairly widely in the old Roman Empire?
Good question. Yes, abortion was practiced widely in the Roman Empire, and also child sacrifice of children to the Roman gods was regarded. However, I'm not a great church historian. I'm just a layman reading church history, but it seems to me that the early church was against abortion almost uniformly up till the first 400 years. The writings were well against abortion, almost uniformly against. And we can sense some of this in Paul's writings, where every place in the scriptures abortion is mentioned, it's mentioned without approbation. And for example, in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says he was an abortion, it's in the light of the Christian response to that Roman paganism that they were experiencing. Now, I think it's also true to say that in the pre-Christian era, that in a number of those dynasties that were respectable, they were against abortion, and such as in the Assyrian Empire, and in a lot of those earlier ones that were around about the time of Abraham, that there were even stiffer penalties than in the New Testament spelled out.
Some time ago, there was a young man down at Scarborough. Went mad with a rifle. He shot a goat, then he shot a horse, then he shot his mother. He was put into jail in the maximum security in Bogger Road. I spoke in the jail one day, and the man got up and he sang the old rugged cross. Now, the pastor that I went in with, he said, that young man, the only emotion he knows is anger. 2 weeks later, in the kitchen, this young man, when the warden had his back towards him, he just picked up an iron rod off the stove and smashed that man's skull in. Now, for no reason at all, they never had words, they never had anything. Now, there was a young man, perhaps he should have been aborted. Would you believe in that? Had they known that such a boy was going to be let live?
I myself would not. Because, again, I'd come down on my friend there with the sovereignty of God. It's not for me to interfere. But that boy's actions are from a defect. Some would say, well, he's obviously a psychopath, and can't distinguish between right and wrong. He doesn't have a moral aspect to his makeup. But if we're going to abort him, we've got to abort the others. Now, I didn't tell you where I stand, but I myself find it a problem with these ladies where we do antenatal fetal testing, and I tell them that I'm prepared to do the test, but if they come back positive, I'm not prepared to go ahead with the abortion. And so that being consistent in that, I would say I wouldn't be prepared to abort him even if I knew that was going to happen.
But something should have been done. That young fellow should not have been allowed loose in the maximum security prison. He should be put somewhere where he wouldn't be dangerous, where he could kill somebody.
Yes, well, yes. This raises the whole question of the outcome, the outworking of sin in the community, isn't it? And that's all within this.
Doctor, what is your view about external fertilization? What do you think about life there? And as a Christian young man who wants to counsel somebody who has or is going to do such a thing, what would you advise them?
I've spoken and written fairly extensively on that subject because I think this is the sort of thing that Christians need to be addressing themselves to. We're opening up a whole can of worms on that one, but if I can say in two sentences, if I can encapsulate it, dreadful word, if I can get it down to, I'd say that provided the sperm used are the sperm of the husband, and the ovum used is the ovum of the wife, and that the embryo that results is implanted back into the wife while both are still alive, I personally don't see anything wrong with it. Because to me, the Genesis 2:24 principle is the one that obtains here, the marriage principle. Anything outside of the marriage, once a foreign element is imported within the marriage from outside, then it becomes wrong. But while it's within the marriage, it's okay. Others disagree with me on that. The professor of theology and I differ on that particular thing because he says it's unnatural.
I know that IFA has written a few books or a few pamphlets.
One.
And I was going to ask him for the time. Perhaps you'd like to tell us where we can acquire it.
I may say it's by now probably 4 years out of date because it takes 2 years to get through to publication. It was published last year in Christian Medical Fellowship series. It's a little booklet of about 50-70 pages, and it's the series is A Christian Doctor Speaks, and this one is a green one. It says on conception and contraception, and it deals with a number of these things such as abortion, IVF, embryo transfer, artificial insemination, the pill and the single girl and such like. And it costs, I think, around about a bit under $2, and it's in the Christian bookshops around the town. At the back of it, there are about 70-odd references that were up to date when it went to publication.
Doctor, there's been a problem simmering in my mind for quite a period of time. I'm in a position where I notice a lot of folk to and from whom work in the government. Some have genetic aberrations, Down syndrome, various kinds of deformities and such like. Now, the thing is this, that if God formed the human from a fetus, as, say, the Catholics believe in, some of the Protestants do too, God being a perfect God would do a perfect work. Now, the child that is born deformed, the only way I can overcome that is this, that God has given man the power to reproduce. The reproduction and all that goes along with it is tainted by sin. Therefore, what are we reaping in that respect is the outcome of sin. Now, the thing is that, all right, now we cannot overcome that aspect of it. God just seems to me that he stands to one side, allow nature to take its course. We've got to reap the consequences. Now, to overcome that, in recent years, there has been definite efforts made by science in what they call genetic engineering. Now, going back again, noting these poor unfortunates going to and fro, I feel very, very much for them. Not what I can do for them, nor anybody else. And therefore, I'm feeling more and more in favour of genetic engineering, providing it's carried out by responsible, morally upright scientists and doctors.
Yes, we're now onto a slightly different subject, which also is a big one. And again, without being too glib, if I can say that in general terms, I agree with you that genetic engineering in itself is a neutral thing, like electricity, either good or bad, and it depends to what use we put it. If we use genetic engineering, say, to produce human insulins or to produce anti-cancer agents which can be injected back into the body to cure cancers, that would be good. If we use it for cloning, to produce clones of either a man or a woman, I would say that that's bad. If we use it to produce human-animal hybrids, that would be bad. And if we also, I'd go so far as to say that if we use it for ectogenesis, the principles involved for growing whole babies up in biochemical milieu, I would say that that is then violating the marriage principle. And anything which does not violate that principle is probably correct. And so I would agree with you on genetic engineering, and in fact there is some work being done on antenatal genetic engineering now, finding some of these defects and trying to work out some ways of correcting them in utero. I would see nothing wrong with that.
Often in relation to the mini pill, the progestogen only pill, is the current evidence suggested that maybe an abortifacient? And also, would you comment on your use in clinical practice from the moral point of view of the IUD?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'll come out bluntly and say I do use the intrauterine contraceptive device because, again, it's a matter of weighing up things. It's possible for us to pay the tithes in the mint and cummin and to neglect the weightier matters of the law. I worked in Africa where there was overpopulation was a problem, where women would have 10, 12 babies. They didn't want them, and nearly half of them died before the age of 5, often of starvation, and they suffered all this bereavement. It was interesting that I worked alongside the Roman Catholics as well, and they, in that situation, were using the intrauterine device, and they know the same as what we do, because as they would tell their people, and in fact the bishop himself, was aware of what was going on and acquiesced to it. So it's a matter of relativity with these things. We're down almost into the part of theological hair splitting, it seems to me, once we get down to is the IUCD an abortifacient or not. Now, I don't want to go and offend anyone whose conscience is very sensitive on these things, but it seems to me that in the big wide world of practicalities, where there are so many people hurting and there are so many things for us to get worried about, we need to get our worries and our concerns into perspective, and that would come a long way down the line. So that I do use the IUCD, even though it may be an abortifacient at present. As far as the progesterone-only pill is concerned, we don't know completely how that works. It probably works more in rendering the cervical mucus hostile to the sperm. In about 30% of people, it does inhibit ovulation, and if it does act as an abortifacient, it is only in a small proportion, would be the state of play as I understand it. And again, if I accept the IUCD, I'm very happy to prescribe the mini pill because it's down even, that's the 20th of the mint and the cumin, as far as I'm concerned. But again, I don't want to go and say that in offence, offending anyone who's got a very sensitive conscience on that sort of thing. It seems to me that sometimes in this matter of sexuality and the things to do with it, that they're the big bad thing, and yet it's the matter of the sins of pride and of irritability and bad temper and relationships and the breaking of the law of love which is a greater sin than sort of offending against some of the things to do with sex. I say that because as we deal with these sexual problems within our church circles, we need to show that love and to get things into perspective. And often we think if a elder commits adultery, runs off with the secretary or such like, that he's out. And there is the need for discipline, but there's also the need for handling that elder or anyone else in the church with love at the same time. And that's every bit as important as the amount of discipline. But I think I'm getting off the subject there.
One more thing later.
Come to the end of the whole show here. There's one real controversial one, probably a little bit away from it, but it has plenty to do with this. I've just been given recently an article on abortion, and if I just could read something from there, it might be interesting to find out whether there's some truth or not in this. So in the middle it says here, by April 83, abortion toll in the United States was 10 million people. In Australia, up to 100,000 abortions are performed in a year. Since 1981, a cosmetic firm in Paris, France, has been making a skincare product designed to rejuvenate skin using youthful cells of aborted babies, especially the spleen, liver, thymus, and intestinal membranes. The use of aborted children in cosmetics came to light when guards at a French-Swiss border encountered a truckload of frozen human fetuses destined for a French cosmetic laboratory. Some of the more shocking facts that will give you a heart palpitation include: a young couple wanted to conceive a child to be aborted so that a father-to-be could use the baby's kidney for a transplant that he needed himself. In California, babies aborted at 6 months were submerged in jars of liquid with high oxygen content to see if they could breathe through the skin. They couldn't. The hysterectomy aborted fetus in the 7th, 8th and 9th months is removed intact. Translated, the baby is alive. The trade in fetal tissue is about $1 million annually. The high prices may encourage unnecessary abortion on welfare patients as the surest way of getting salable tissue. Human embryos and other organs have been encased in plastic and sold as paper vials as novelty. The diabetes treatment project at UCLA depends for its existence on the availability of pancreas from late-term aborted fetuses. A rapist vaccine is produced from viruses grown in the lungs of aborted children, according to the FDA. Polio vaccines was also grown in cells from aborted kidneys. Brain cells would be harvested from aborted babies for a transplant. Tissue cultures are obtained by dropping still living babies into meat grinders and homogenize them, according to the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. And they are stating facts like this of what embryos are being used for. Is there any truth, or is there a possibility of a truth to this?
Well, I should imagine there is. People speak out against that. We rightly are filled with horror with that sort of thing, but what we've got to be careful of is that we don't use extremes to illustrate the general. I'm assuming here tonight that we as Christians find an easy approach to abortion abhorrent, and that not one of us would have a liberal approach to abortion. I'm assuming that if your daughter came to you and she was pregnant and single and mine came to me, I'd like to think that even though it would be a dreadful thing, we'd feel devastated, that we would not suggest abortion in that case. Many others outside would. I'm assuming that if you're an elder of an assembly and a young girl is caught in this way and you're asked to advise, that you will view abortion with severity, but you'll also recognise that there are difficulties with these other avenues that are open, and that you'll get behind with supportive care. If we're not going to help them with the abortion, we've got to, if we're not going to condone abortion, which we're not, generally speaking, we have to provide supportive care. So that we would say, all of us would say how bad that is, that there is such an easy approach to abortion, and that this follows on from that, and that we hope that never happens here. What I am saying is that we recognise that there are a lot of complex, that there are some complex cases out on the fringe, perhaps 1 or 2%.